Even still, no one truly knows what a delver is, the voice continued, and icons looking like confused faces lined the sides of my canopy. These recordings are almost 200 years old, taken when the Acumidian Delver appeared and destroyed the planet Farhaven. Every living being on the planet was turned to dust and vaporized. How scary! My canopy view zoomed in on the Delver, as if I'd suddenly flown up to it. I jumped, despite myself. From this close, it looked like a thunderstorm of dust and energy. But deep within it, I saw the shadow of something smaller, a circular, shifting something. When delvers enter our realm, the voice said, matter coalesces around them. We think they must bring it through the place they come from. Freaky. This matter forms a shroud around the delver. The creature itself is much smaller. At the very center of all this dust, rock, and debris is a metallic shell sometimes called a delver maze. Standard shields protect pilots from whatever it is about the delver that vaporizes people, so that's nice, isn't it? But those shields don't last long against a delver's attacks, and even planetary shields usually fall within a matter of minutes. Still, shielded ships can get close, and some have even traveled inside the dust, past the debris, and into the maze itself. There, they encountered a complicated network of twisting tubes and corridors made from stone and metal. The image of the Delver vanished, replaced by a large cartoon version. It had angry eyebrows and vaguely human features, and a pair of cartoon hands pulled back the cloud of dust, revealing a polyhedral structure with a lumpy, malformed exterior. It wasn't as polished or angular as the one we were going to train on. On the real thing, spines jutted out at various places. It was like a cross between a large asteroid, a melted chunk of steel, and a sea urchin. The smaller chunks that the Delver expels chase after ships, the voice explained, and cartoon meteors shot out from the Delver in pursuit of little animated ships. They'll try to bring down your shield so the Delver can munch on you. Stay away. They move with no visible source of propulsion. Maybe they're magic. Reports say that fighting these embers is like trying to dogfight inside an asteroid field, when all the asteroids are actively trying to kill you. The Delver itself lurks at the center of the maze. Our special Delver attack devices won't work through the interference. So, you'll need to fly into the maze and find the Delver itself. It's in there somewhere. Your training will include test runs through our specially created imitation maze. Good luck, and hopefully you won't die. Thank you. After that, a list of people who had made the orientation video scrolled across my screen, many with little cute symbols next to their names. When it was finally done, my canopy went transparent again, giving me a good view of the large training maze that, compared to the Delver, seemed far too ordinary. I settled back, feeling a mounting dread. I was increasingly certain the superiority was filled with people who were taking this threat far too lightly.
All right, Vapor said with a soft, calming voice. They've sent us orders. We're to proceed to the following coordinates, then wait our turn at the maze.
Chapter 22. Vapor led us on a careful approach of the maze. From up closer, I could see the lines where different segments had been fabricated, then fitted together. It didn't have all the dust around it, like the kind that shrouded a real Delver maze. That left this experience feeling even more mundane. It just didn't evoke the same sense of dread and worry that the videos had.
Command says to watch for interceptors, Vapor told us. The Delvers have fighters that attack those who get close.
Not fighters, Braid said in her stern voice. The Delver controls hunks of rock, called embers, which tried to intercept and collide with ships that get near.
All right, Vapor said. I asked, and Command assured me that this won't be as dangerous as our initial test was. Apparently, some people in the department made the brilliant connection that if you kill all your recruits before you have time to train them, you'll soon run out of recruits. I smiled. The more Vapor spoke, the more conversational her tone became, and the less creepy she seemed. "That's a relief," I said.
"Well, I still would be careful," she answered. "The Superiority hasn't done much training like this since the Human Wars. For now, let's get back into formation."
I boosted forward at the order, settling into my position at the front of our team. Unfortunately, the others didn't have nearly as much experience with battle formations as I did. Mortimer hung back too far, and Hesho tried to keep up with me until Vapor reminded him that his ship was to remain near the center. And Braid, well, Braid flew forward, far out of our pattern. Scud. They were all competent pilots, but we weren't a true flight. We didn't have experience fighting together. Cobb had spent weeks pounding flight maneuvers into Skyward Flight's thick heads. He hadn't let us fight or even use our guns until we'd practiced flight drills so much that we instinctively knew how to maneuver as a team. That had saved our lives a dozen times over when the fighting had gotten bad. Here, as soon as the enemy came at us, in the form of drones that had been outfitted with rock casings to imitate flying asteroids, the team broke apart. Braid darted in to attack them without a word from Vapor. Mortimer started shooting, but, well, their shots were way off, and I had to boost farther out of formation to be sure they didn't accidentally hit me. And to be honest, I undercompensated, as this new ship wasn't as responsive as MBOT, and I wasn't used to how it maneuvered. Vapor was so busy talking to us that she forgot that her job as sniper was to start blasting the enemy ships while they were distracted. The only one of us who didn't embarrass himself was Hesho, whose ship performed its ordered maneuvers with precision. The diminutive fox poet might have been a little dramatic, but his crew was obviously well-trained. He managed to bring down four of the drones. These drones didn't act like the ones we fought on Detritus. Whoever was piloting them had been instructed not to dodge, but just fly around and try to collide with us. Which made sense, since they were imitating chunks of stone being moved by the Delver. I was glad to see that when one got close enough to have hit Mortimer, however, it broke off before colliding and instead radioed to say Mortimer was dead. So maybe the Superiority really had learned not to use live fire during training. We regrouped for another run, and again Braid engaged the embers immediately. Mortimer, apparently thinking that they should use Braid as a model, waded into the fight and nearly got smashed up by an approaching drone for the second time. This one didn't pull back fast enough, but I barely managed to spear it with my light lance and tow it away. I was rewarded by Mortimer panicking and shooting at me in a moment of confusion. Hesho, sensing that his allies were in trouble, barreled forward and started shooting in all directions. A private line opened from Vapor to me.
"Wow," she said softly. "They seem confused."
"Confused? It's a mess. This flight needs way more work on fundamentals."
"If you think so, then give the orders."
"You're the flight leader."
"And I'm making you my assistant flight leader," Vapor said. "How would you fix this situation? I'm curious."
Great. I had no leadership experience. But I winced, watching the others fight. Someone needed to stop this before we ended up as rubble. "What do you idiots think you're doing?" I shouted into the general line. That was the most embarrassing excuse of a hostile approach I've ever seen. "Braid, you were ordered to clear the firing path, not fetch a fist of enemy nose hairs. Mortimer, get back here. Don't learn bad habits by chasing someone who disobeys orders. And Hesho, you're flying well, but you have the fire control of a child with a new toy. Everyone, disengage and fall back." Next, I temporarily added the weights and measures to the channel. "Flight Command," I said. Flight 15 is going to need to run some exercises and learn how to coordinate. Call back the drones and reset their attack vectors. Don't send them in again until I say we're ready for it. Pardon? A voice asked. You're supposed to try flying into one of those approach tunnels in the... I'm not letting my flight anywhere near your training machine until I'm sure they can fly in formation, I shouted. Right now, I'm convinced they'll mistake their own backsides for the approach tunnels and end up rammed so far up there we'll need spelunking gear to get them out. Hesho chuckled softly on the line. Flight Command said. I guess we can do that? The others started flying back, and the drones disengaged. Braid kept flying toward the Delver maze, though, so I opened a private line to her. Braid, I'm serious. Vapor made me her XO, and I'm giving you an order. You damn well better get back in line, or I will flay you. I hear people will pay good money for a human skin to hang on their walls. With obvious reluctance, Braid disengaged and spun around to boost back toward us. And had that all really come out of my mouth? I sat back in my seat, my heart thundering inside me as if I'd run a race. I hadn't specifically intended to say any of that. It had all just kind of happened. Scud. Cobb would be laughing his head off if he could hear me right now. As the others gathered back together, a private call came to me from Vapor.
Well done, she said, but perhaps a tad aggressive for this group. Where did you learn to talk like that?
I had an interesting flight instructor back home.
Tone it down, Vapor suggested. But I agree with you. We should do some more training before we fight. Organize them to do so.
You're really going to make me do the hard part, aren't you? I said.
A good commander knows when to appoint a good drill instructor. You've been in the military before. You obviously know this.
I sighed, but she was right, and I'd walked right into the job. As the flight gathered together, I explained one of Cobb's old formation exercises, one he'd adapted for space fighting once we'd started training out in the vacuum. Vapor quietly joined the line, and soon I had them flying pretty much in an organized way. As much as I hated being put in charge, I could run these exercises practically in my sleep, so I was good at watching the others and giving them tips. They soon got the hang of it, much faster than Skyward Flight had, actually. This group had good piloting instincts. Most just didn't have formal combat training. Vapor is used to working on her own, I decided, as we flew through a shifting exercise where we traded places in formation to confuse an oncoming enemy flight. Morimer was timid, but willing to learn. Hesho was accustomed to having people follow his lead, and was often surprised when the rest of us didn't know instinctively what he wanted to do. He needed to learn better communication. Braid was the worst. Though she was the best pilot, she kept trying to go on ahead, far too eager. You need to stay with the rest of us, I said, calling her. Don't keep trying to go ahead. I'm a human, Braid snapped. We're aggressive. Deal with it. Just earlier, you said you didn't spend time around humans, I said, and therefore didn't know their habits. You can't play the I'm not like them card, then use your nature as a human as an excuse. I try to hold back, Braid said. But deep down, I know the truth. I'm going to lose my temper. It's hopeless to plan for anything else. That's a load of yesterday's slop, I said. When I started training, I was hopeless. I lost my temper so often, you could have set your clock by my tantrums. Really? Braid asked. Really? I literally assaulted my flight leader in class one day. But I learned. So can you. She fell silent, but seemed to be trying harder as we went through another exercise. As the day progressed, and we stopped for lunch in our cockpits, I found myself most impressed by Morimer. All things considered, their flying ability was remarkable, and they were extremely eager to learn. Yeah, they couldn't aim worth spit, but Cobb had always said he'd rather have students who could fly well. Those could stay alive long enough to be taught to fight. I pulled my ship up beside Mortimer's as we finished lunch and moved back into formation. "Hey," I said, "when we do this next batch, try to watch and stay tighter in formation. You keep veering toward the outside." "I'm sorry," they said. "I'll do better. And also, I'm sorry I almost shot you earlier." That was nothing. At least you didn't mean to try to kill me. That's more than I can say for most. They chuckled, though I thought I could hear tension in their voice. I remembered my first few training sessions under Cobb, the worry that I'd get something wrong and be kicked out, the growing lack of confidence that I belonged, the frustration at not being able to do all the things I'd imagined myself capable of accomplishing. "Don't worry," I told them. "You're doing fine, particularly considering how new to this you are." "As I mentioned, my left parent was a drone pilot during their youth," Mortimer said. "I got a piece of that experience, fortunately."
"You really get skills from your parents?"
"Of course," Mortimer said. "Some of the knowledge and skills of the parents pass on to the child. I guess it isn't that way for your species?"
"Was it?" Scud. I didn't actually know, at least not for Alanique's species. Without Embot there to whisper explanations into my ear, I could get myself into trouble.
"Anyway, I was lucky in this," Mortimer continued, "but also unlucky. My left parent has had some latent aggression, and I ended up with an extra measure of it. My first few days alive, I got a reputation for snapping at others."
"Snapping at people is aggressive among your kind?"
"Very," Mortimer said.
"Wow. I'd have never made it to being born. They'd have killed me right out."
"That's a common misconception," Mortimer said. "If my parents decide not to bear me with this personality, I won't be killed. They'll simply recombine me in a new way. What you see in me is just a draft, a prospect, a possibility of who I could be. Though, if I were to be born, I'd retain these memories, and my personality would become real."
They paused.
"And I do wish for that to be the case."
I tried to imagine a world where I remembered being forced to prove I was worth existing. No wonder this society had issues. We finished the next batch of exercises, and I was pleased at how well the group kept formation.
"This is actually working," I said, calling Vapor. "I think we might be able to make something of them."
"Excellent," Vapor said. "Are they ready for combat then?"
"Scud, no," I said. "We need to be at this for another few weeks at least. They're good pilots, so it's not like starting with raw recruits. But that doesn't mean I want them shooting at anything yet." Vapor seemed to take that in stride and didn't complain or even ask for more details. She simply said,
"Interesting."
How was I to interpret that?
"Let's give them another break," she eventually said to me. "Then we'll try some higher speed formations. We have 3 hours until we return to Starsight for the day. Flight Command has been asking if any of us will be heading into the maze. I'll tell them that we don't anticipate it."
"All right," I said, slowing my ship and pulling out my canteen.
"Unless, of course," she added, "you want to give it a try while the others are on break. You and I could head in there together."
I hesitated, canteen halfway to my lips.
"It would be useful, after all, to know what it is we're preparing for," Vapor said. "I've heard of Delver mazes, but I've never been in one."
Her ship hovered up beside me, and it was disconcerting to see the cockpit empty, as if it were piloted by a ghost. What was Vapor's game? In putting me in charge of running the exercises, she'd been able to go back to observing, participating, but remaining mostly mysterious. Now she wanted me to go into the maze with her. It seemed a test of some sort, a challenge. I looked out toward the maze,
Each flight had been assigned a different face of the dodecahedron, and the pilots had been practicing approaching and then flying into it. I'm up for it, I decided, putting away my canteen. Tell flight command to call off those drones, though. We can train on fighting them later.
Done, Vapor said. Let's go.
Chapter 23. Flight command reluctantly did as requested and pulled back the drones this once so that Vapor and I could fly in uncontested. I got a better sense for the size of the thing as we flew into its shadow. It was roughly as wide as one of the platforms around Detritus, but that was just its diameter. In total mass, it must have been a dozen times as large. Not planetary scale, and therefore smaller than the full Delvers I'd seen in the videos, but still dauntingly enormous. Each face of the dodecahedron had dozens of holes in it, punctures roughly 20 meters across. Vapor and I picked one at random and drew in close enough that I could see that the rest of the face was polished metal. I found myself growing excited. I was increasingly fascinated by the Delvers, an emotion that walked hand in hand with my growing worry about them, maybe even fear of them. I couldn't shake that image I'd seen back on Detritus, me, standing where the Delver should have been. Whatever it meant to be a Cytonic, whatever I was, it had to do with these things and the place where they lived. This isn't a real one, I reminded myself. This is just an imitation for training, like a practice dummy to use in sword fighting. We paused right outside our chosen tunnel, looking as if into the throat of the beast. I kept expecting Embot to chime in with an analysis, and found the silence of my canopy daunting. So, I said, calling Vapor, we just go into one of these tunnels?
Yes, she replied. Reports from pilots who survived entering a real maze indicate all the tunnels looked the same. If there is a reason to pick one over another, we don't yet know what it is.
Follow my lead then, I guess, I asked, inching my ship forward at 1/10 of a mag, the starship equivalent of a crawl. The inside was pitch black. Though I could fly by instruments alone, I often had to out in space, I hit my floodlights. I wanted visuals on this place. The inside of the tunnel narrowed to about 15 meters across, cramped confines on starfighter scales. I let myself move at barely a creep as I flew forward. Behind me, several drones broke off the wall near the entrance and started moving in our direction. Flight command, I said. I thought you were told to let us do this run without pursuit. The person on the channel said. When you actually fight a Delver, they'll chase you. We'll never get to the part about fighting a Delver if we die during these practice runs, I said. Call off the drones and let Vapor and me get our feet underneath us. Trust me, I've done a lot more training than you.
Okay, the Dione said. No need to be so aggressive.
These people. I rolled my eyes, but they called off the drones as requested. Vapor's seemingly empty ship moved up beside mine. Embot had said she flew not by moving the control sphere or pushing buttons, but by interrupting and overriding the electrical signals sent by the controls to the rest of the ship. So, did that mean she was the ship, after a manner? Like she was a spirit that could possess electronics? Now what? I asked. We're just supposed to fly around in these tunnels? Looking for what? The center?
The heart, Vapor said. But it's not always at the center. After surviving pilots flew through the maze for a time, a few reported discovering a chamber with atmosphere and gravity. Inside that chamber was a smaller one, sealed off by a membrane that seemed like living tissue. When they drew close, they heard voices in their minds and claimed to have known the Delver was inside.
All right, I said. That sounds vague. Even assuming that they were right, how are we supposed to find this heart of the maze? This thing is bigger than a carrier ship. We could probably fly in here for days and not explore every chamber.
I don't think that is a problem, Vapor said. Pilots who entered the real maze and who survived long enough all eventually found the membrane.
She hesitated.
Most flew back, frightened and fearing for their sanity after reaching it. Several entered, but none of those returned.
Delightful. Well, I hoped to never have to face a real Delver, but certainly anything I experienced in here might be useful to my people. I flew farther into the tunnel, my proximity sensors mapping the ways various parts branched off. However, I found myself relying on eyesight, leaning forward, staring out of my canopy at the passing tunnel. It was like a corridor with a uniform pattern of panels and grooves. I've seen this before, I thought, feeling a chill. Haven't I? Yes. I'd gone into a structure like this chasing Ned, who had followed his brothers inside. It had been an enormous shipyard, and I'd had to dodge through its tunnels as it fell. The shape of this tunnel, with those ridges at points where metal plates met, was exactly the same. We entered a larger open room with more branching tunnels coming off it. Here I used maneuvering thrusters to position myself near the ceiling, where a strange set of markings had been stamped into the metal. I've seen these before too, I thought, shifting my floodlights to bathe the ceiling in light. I craned my neck to peer at the markings. They looked like a strange alien language. Flight command, I said. Can you hear me? Silence. Then finally, a voice replied, We can. The maze has signal boosters installed. But when you're inside a real maze, interference sometimes prevents communication. It's best if you pretend the same might happen here. Sure, I said. But first, what's this writing on the ceiling near me? Those appear to be replicas made from pictures taken by pilots inside a real Delver maze. They have no meaning that we've been able to interpret.
Huh, I said. I swear I've seen them somewhere before.
Do you want us to engage the maze's other defensive features? Flight Command asked. Or do you just want to fly around in it?
What defensive features are we talking about? I asked.
A real Delver maze causes those who enter it to hallucinate, the operator explained. We've imitated this by giving you ships with holographic canopies that can project strange sights. When entering the maze, you should always take another pilot with you.
Why is that? I asked. For backup? No, Vapor whispered. Because they each see different things, don't they? I've heard of this.
Yes, the operator said. The maze affects the minds of those who enter it in different ways, and each individual will see something different. Usually, if both pilots in a team see the same thing, it's real and not a hallucination. If you see different things, you'll know they're not real. In addition, other conclusions can be drawn by comparing what you see.
Turn it on, I said, tapping on my maneuvering thrusters. I moved down into the hollow center of the room, next to Vapor's ship. The chamber flickered, then changed, red colors blossoming out from one wall, like blood bleeding from some underground well. It coated the wall, painting everything a deep crimson. Vapor, I whispered. What do you see? A black darkness, she replied, covering everything and swallowing light.
I see blood, I said. It didn't seem dangerous, but it was certainly creepy. Let's keep moving.
I boosted out of the large chamber, passing into another tunnel. Though it was the same size as the one I'd traveled through earlier, it felt even more claustrophobic and constricting because the walls seemed to be made of flesh. They undulated and shivered, like I was actually moving through the veins of some enormous beast. When I emerged into the next room, the appearance shifted again. Suddenly, I seemed to be inside an ancient stone cavern, moss dangling from the ceiling in wide swaths. Though I knew it was just a hologram, these changes left me unnerved. Vapor hovered up beside me. I see the walls as if they were glass. What do you see?
Stone and moss, I said. It's thickest on the right over there.
I see glass shards floating in the air there. Perhaps the maze is obscuring something?
Yeah, I said, nudging closer. Sure enough, the proximity sensors indicated there was a tunnel hiding back there, obscured by the hologram. I eased my ship down through it and emerged into the next chamber. However, as I did, the shadows behind my ship moved. I immediately spun the vessel around on its axis, pointing my floodlights in that direction. I was facing down a large pile of alien fungus, pulsing softly as if breathing, each bulbous toadstool the size of my fighter. "Did you see that?" I asked Vapor as she hovered her ship down beside me.
"No. What did you see?"
"Motion," I said, narrowing my eyes. Something else darted away at the edges of my vision, and I spun my ship again.
"Proximity sensors show nothing," Vapor said. "It must be part of the hologram."
"Flight command?" I asked. "What was that motion?" The response that came back was jumbled and broken, my communications cutting out. The shadows in this room were moving. I spun again, trying to catch whatever was in here. "Flight command," I asked again. "I'm not reading you." "Do you want an authentic experience or not?" The voice came back to me, suddenly clear. "I told you that when pilots get deeper within the maze, communication starts to get more erratic." "Okay, fine. But what are those shadows?" "What shadows?" "The ones that keep moving in this room," I said. "Is there something inside this maze that will attack me?"
Not sure."
"What do you mean you're not sure?"
Just a sec."
Vapor and I hung there with the shadows, until another voice came on our line, one that was more excitable and enthusiastic. Winzik, head of the Krell.
"Alanique, it's Winzik. I hear you're experiencing some of the maze's more unnerving features."
"You could say that," I said. Winzik's voice sounded small, as if the signal from outside were a frail thread close to snapping.
"There's something in here with us," Vapor said. "I think I saw it too just now."
"My, my," Winzik said. "Well, it's probably just the holograms."
"Probably?" I asked.
"Well, we're not 100% sure how this works ourselves," Winzik said. "We aren't adding moving shadows to your canopy holograms, but there might be other holograms in here created by the maze. We didn't build it, remember? We recovered it, repaired it, and added our own drones, but it was built by humans. We're not entirely certain what it can do, or what extents it can reach, to imitate a true Delver maze."
"So we're lab animals?" I said, growing increasingly annoyed. "Testing something you don't understand? You toss us in and see who survives?"
"Now, now," Winzik said. "Don't be so aggressive, Alanique. Aren't your people trying to gain citizenship and the superiority? Yelling at me won't help you with that goal, I assure you. Anyway, good job in there. Keep it up."
The channel cut off, and I barely held myself back from cussing him out. How dare he be so perky? Well, that friendly attitude was obviously just an act for my benefit. Krell were terrible and destructive, as proven by how they treated my people. Did Winzik think an affable voice would hide that reality from others?
"Let's get back out and check on the others," Vapor said,
turning to lead me out the way we'd come in. I followed, and though the next room was the same one we'd come through before, the moss was gone, and it just looked normal now. Again, it reminded me of the old shipyard from Detritus. Had that been another maze like this, intended for the same purpose? Or was I jumping to conclusions?
"Your people," Vapor said as we flew, "have a history with the humans. Do you not?"
Yeah, I said, sitting up in my seat. Vapor didn't normally make small talk.
Curious, she said.
That was years before I was born, I said.
Human domination altered the future of your planet, Vapor said. Your people fought beside them and inevitably adopted some of their ways. You speak a variation on one of their languages.
Vapor was silent for a time as we entered the tunnel that had looked like flesh.
Your aggression reminds me of theirs, she finally added.
What about you? I said. Have you ever met humans? Other than Braid, I mean.
Many, Vapor said in her soft, airy voice. I fought them.
In the wars? I asked, surprised. The most recent was 100 years ago. You were alive then? Vapor gave no specific confirmation, and we soon entered the large chamber with the writing on the ceiling, which had appeared to have blood on the walls before. Now it looked like a mirror gallery, reflecting back at me 1,000 versions of my own ship. I cocked my head and spun my ship, looking at the thousands of versions of my vessel. Until I pointed at one mirror that held not my ship, but just an image of me floating there, in space, alone. Not Alanique, me, Spensa. The version of me looked up and met my eyes, despite the distance, and I felt a growing coldness. That wasn't a reflection. It was one of them. I hit the call button, but the room went black, and even my floodlights went out. I was left hanging as if in a void of nothing, like I'd entered the nowhere. My hand froze on the call button. But before I could speak, everything went back to normal. In the blink of an eye, I was in my cockpit again, hanging in that ancient room, Vapor moving her ship toward the exit.
Coming, Alanique?
Vapor's voice crackled onto my communication channel mid-sentence.
Or are you just going to sit there?
I'm coming, I said, trying to shake the creepy feeling. What do you see back there?
Just a room, Vapor said. Why?
I shook my head, then guided my ship back out into open space, where I breathed a sigh of relief. Chapter 24. Outside, Vapor had me run the team through a few scatter formations, a maneuver where the flight would break apart and fly in different directions, then regroup. I figured those would be useful when fighting something like the Embers, which would try to smash into us. The others must have felt my shift in mood, because nobody gave me lip, and even Braid went through the exercises without complaint. Before long, it was time to head back to the weights and measures, the day's training finished. I landed my ship in the docking bay, then gave her console a fond pat. She wasn't M-Bot, but she was a solidly built fighter. I popped the canopy and hopped down to join the others, and I could read in their attitudes a kind of exhausted enthusiasm. Exhausted because it had been a long day of training, but enthusiastic because it had been good training. We'd made progress, and were already starting to feel like a team. Hesho laughed heartily at something that Morimer said, and was again joined by the female Kitson in the red uniform, carrying a shield. I'd learned she was named Kauri, and was the ship's navigator, as well as Hesho's shield bearer, though I wasn't exactly sure what that meant in this context. As we walked together, I found that I could pick out a few of the other Kitson by their voices. It was strange to think that our flight included not just the 5 pilots, but all 57 Kitson crew members as well. I liked it. I liked how much energy it brought us. It almost helped me forget the strange things I'd felt and seen in the maze. We were ordered back to the jump room, and though a drone arrived to lead the way, Braid tried to rush on ahead, perhaps to keep from being forced to interact with us. I walked faster to catch up to her. Hey, I said. I like that maneuver you pulled just before we ended, the one where you wove between other members of the flight without hitting them. Braid shrugged. It was simple. You've got flight experience, I noted. Obviously. Well, I'm glad to have you on the team.
You sure about that? She said. You know what I am.
Sooner or later, I'm going to lose it, and there will be casualties.
I'm counting on it, I said.
She stopped in place, standing in the red carpeted hallway, frowning at me.
What?
Where I come from, I said softly. A little passion is a good thing to have in a pilot. I'm not afraid of a little aggression, Braid. I think we can use it.
You have no idea what you're asking for, she snapped at me, then hurried on.
I lingered until the others caught up, then walked with them to our jump room. This time, I didn't try to continue on toward the engine room. The guard there was already suspicious of me, judging by how their eyes followed me as I passed. As we settled into our seats, I focused on doing Grand Grand's exercise. I closed my eyes and let my mind float out, imagining myself soaring among the stars. And I listened. The voices of the chattering Kitson faded away. There. Hyperdrive ready, a voice said. It wasn't in English, but as always, language didn't matter. My mind picked out the meaning. Why were they communicating via cytonics? It was just the bridge calling the engine room.
Excellent.
That was from Winzik.
Engage.
I braced myself, waiting, but nothing happened. What? A moment later, another communication was sent. Engine room, is there a problem?
Yes, unfortunately, the reply came. We're reading cytonic interference from localized sources inside the ship.
I felt a spike of alarm. They knew I was here.
Oh, that, Winzik said. Yes, that's to be expected. We've got two of them traveling with us now.
It's going to cause a problem, sir, engineering sent back.
How much of one?
We'll have to see. We're swapping out the hyperdrive unit now. A fresh one might work, as long as we engage it immediately.
I waited, tense. A few minutes passed. Then it happened again. Another dump of information into my mind. This one pointed towards Starsight. Then a scream. I felt that same disorienting sense of being thrown into a vast blackness. Again, the Delvers didn't see me. They were focused on the scream. I slammed back into my seat, my mind throbbing. Again, I sagged in my straps, though none of the others even broke conversation. They didn't realize it had happened. That sensation I'd felt, that dump of information, it told me where the hyperjump was going to go. I could have used that information to jump myself to Starsight. That information was fading, but slowly. I might be able to jump myself from here to the Delver maze and back again, if I needed to. The random numbers that MBOT had told me didn't work, but something about this information injected directly into my mind, that did. It proved what I had suspected, that I needed to be able to do more than just know my destination. I had to be able to feel it. It was a clue, my first solid one, on how I might be able to control my powers. Worn out, I rose with the others and trudged to the pickup bay, which looked out towards Starsight. A vibrant, glowing blue platform with buildings sprouting from it like stalactites and stalagmites. I bade farewell to the others, then climbed into my assigned shuttle. Unfortunately, I wasn't allotted my own this time, as an official sent a trio of reptilian aliens in after me. Apparently, their housing was near mine. They gathered in the back seats, chatting softly in their own language, my pin translating helpfully. Since they were just talking about dinner plans, I flipped off the translator. The shuttle took off, and the moment we left the docking bay, a voice erupted through my earpiece.
Spencer? MBOT asked. Spencer, I'm picking up your signal again. Are you well? Is everything all right? It's been 8 hours without communication.
Hearing that voice was shockingly welcome, and I found myself sighing in relief. My task was feeling increasingly more intimidating by the moment, but this one point of familiarity reminded me I wasn't completely alone. I'm back,
I whispered to him, then eyed the aliens behind me. I'll explain more when I get to the embassy.
Scud, that's good to hear,
Embot said.
Did you hear that? I just swore. If I started swearing, do you think it would prove that I'm alive? Lifeless computers don't swear. That would be weird.
I don't think you can argue that you're not weird.
Of course I can. I can argue basically anything, if I'm programmed for it. Anyway, they must have some kind of communications shield over the weights and measures. When I lost your signal, I feared I'd been left alone with the slug forever.
I smiled, and was actually starting to feel excited as we approached my building. I had so much to explain to Embot. The Delver maze, Vapor. I'd made some inroads with Braid, hadn't I? Unfortunately, as the shuttle approached, I found that Mrs. Chamwit, the Krell housekeeper that Kuna had assigned me, was waiting at the front door. What's she still doing here? I whispered, eyeing the armored alien woman as my shuttle settled down.
Once she finished cleaning, she spent the time waiting for you to return, Embot answered.
She was really committed to her spying, wasn't she? As I climbed out of the shuttle, she bustled over, speaking with an energetic voice.
Welcome back, mistress. I've looked into your species' nutritional requirements, and I think I have just the recipe for dinner tonight. A Kokian pudding. It's a wonderful mixture of sweet and savory.
I said. No thanks. I've got some food already. I ordered it a couple days ago.
Mistress, the algae strips in your refrigeration unit?
Sure, I said. They're fine. Bland, but fine.
Well, maybe I could work those into a side dish, Mrs. Chamwit said. Or maybe just make you a dessert.
I'm fine, I said. Really, thanks. I have some work to do tonight and don't want to be interrupted. She gestured in a crestfallen way, though I didn't buy the act. If the Krell woman was sad, it was only because I wasn't giving her the chance to spy. Eventually, after three more reassurances that I was fine, she tromped off down the street to leave for the day. I sighed, wiping my brow, then hiked up the steps to the top of the building and climbed into Embot's cockpit. Dim the canopy, I said, and make sure the alien spy has really left. The canopy dimmed.
I'm not convinced she's a spy, Spensa, Embot said. She didn't look through your things. She just straightened up your room, then spent the time doing word puzzles on her tablet.
Straightening up is a perfect cover for spying. I leaned back in the seat and scratched under Doomslug's chin. The slug trilled piteously and looked lethargic as she inched toward me. So I picked her up and settled her into my lap. I'd never seen her move this slowly. Something about this place seemed to be making her feel sick. All right, Embot, I said. We have a problem. We might need to hijack that entire carrier ship.
Excellent, Embot said. Would you like your corpse cremated or ejected into space?
I grinned. Nice.
Humor is an essential identifier of a living being, Embot said. I've been working on some subroutines to help me better recognize and make jokes.
You can just do that, huh? I said. Reprogram yourself to be something new.
I have to be careful, Embot said, as another essential part of being alive is persistence of personality. I don't want to change who I am too much. Beyond that, there are certain things that, if I try to rewrite, will send me into...
Click, 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 click. I sighed and settled back in the seat, petting Doomslug. She was soft and springy. Even the spines on her back, which she fluted out of, weren't that stiff.
I'm back, Embot finally said, then heaved an exaggerated sigh. That is annoying. Anyway, you were saying something about a suicide mission trying to hijack an entire superiority capital ship?
It's not a full capital ship, I said. There's probably only, say, 50 or 60 crew members on board. I launched into an explanation of what had happened to me today, the conversations I'd overheard, the the Delver maze, the interactions with the other pilots and Vapor, even the strange experiences inside the maze itself. So, I said, summing up, I'm not going to be given a ship with a hyperdrive, which means we'll have to find another way.
Curious, Embot said. And you can hear the orders that Winzik is giving the engine room. Why?
I guess they're communicating through the nowhere.
From one end of the ship to the other? Embot asked. That doesn't make any sense. Simple wired communication should be enough. Are you sure that's what you're hearing?
No, I said, honestly. And hearing isn't even the right word. I sat, thoughtful for a moment before speaking again. We might not need to hijack the entire ship.
Good, because the slug would be the only one left after you get yourself killed, and I'm not sure I want her to be my pilot.
I feel like something odd is going on in that engine room, I explained. Plus, on our way back from the Delver maze, something went wrong with the hyperdrive because of me. They swapped it out with another, so the hyperdrive units must be small enough to replace quickly.
We knew that already, Embot said. I used to have something in that empty box in my hull where my hyperdrive was supposed to be.
I nodded, thinking everything through while rubbing Doomslug's head. She fluted in contentment. I teleported Embot twice on my own, but his systems did claim to have a cytonic hyperdrive. I'd assumed that his previous pilot, Commander Spears, had been the actual hyperdrive that had gotten Embot to Detritus. But why have the empty box? There was a huge piece of this that I was missing. We need to find a way to sneak in there and watch them servicing or engaging the hyperdrive. Scud. Maybe if I could steal the device they use to indicate their destination, I could use it to make my own powers work and at least get us home.
By your account, that is a secure location, Embot said, inside a well-patrolled military ship. Sneaking in will not be easy.
Fortunately, we have access to a spy ship and an advanced AI designed for stealth operations. We need to retrieve data from a secure enemy location. What does your programming think we should do?
We should plant espionage devices, Embot said immediately. The best solution would be to use autonomous drones, which could infiltrate the location and make recordings. The carrier's shielding will prevent signals from being sent out, but that would be inadvisable anyway, as it would let scanners detect them. Instead, we would retrieve the devices manually, then download their information.
He paused.
Ooh, that's a good idea. I'm smarter than myself sometimes, aren't I?
Maybe, I said, leaning back in the seat. Do we have any such devices?
No, Embot said. I have berths for housing a few small remote drones, but they are empty.
Can we build a new one? I asked, holding up my arm and inspecting the bracelet that projected my hologram. Like we built a new one of these?
It's possible, Embot said. We'd need to cannibalize some of my sensor systems and order some new parts, and we'd have to do so without the orders looking suspicious. A curious challenge.
Mull it over, I said, yawning. Let me know what you come up with. He settled in to do some computing, and I must have drifted off, because I woke up a short time later to the sound of Doomslug imitating someone snoring, which totally couldn't have been me. Warriors, of course, never snore. That would alert our enemies to our sleeping locations. I stretched, then climbed out of the cockpit into a city that, regardless of the hour, was in constant motion. I stood at the edge of the rooftop, looking out over the endless metropolis, and couldn't help but feel overwhelmed. Igneous, the greatest city my people had ever built, could have been swallowed up by a few city blocks of Starsight. So many people, so many resources, all focused on destroying, or at least suppressing, Detritus. It was a miracle we were doing as well as we were. A light on the computer up here, used for doing ship diagnostics and for monitoring the building, indicated that I'd gotten a delivery. I climbed down the steps, thinking at first that M-Bot must have already ordered some parts for building our spy drone. In the delivery box, I instead found a small pastry with the note, "Just in case the algae is stale, Mrs. Chamwit." The warrior inside me didn't want to eat it, not out of fear of poisoning. If Kuno wanted me poisoned, all they'd have to do was inject something into my building's water supply. But because it felt like admitting defeat to Mrs. Chamwit. It turned out to be the tastiest defeat I'd ever suffered. Chapter 25. A week later, I swooped through a complex dodging maneuver, boosting my ship between multiple enemies, the embers, the burning asteroids that the Delver Maze would eject to intercept fighters. Although the illusion was disturbed by the fact that these ones were just superiority drones wearing a disguise, the combat was exhilarating. I had some 10 tailing me now, increasing speed, accelerating even faster than I could in my quick interceptor. I swept up alongside one face of the Delver Maze. From this close, it was like I was flying across a large, polished metal surface. The structure was so huge it had noticeable gravity, and I had to monitor my acclivity ring to keep from being pulled off course. Embers chased after me, burning from within with a molten light. More came in from the side, trying to press me in against the maze, removing my options for escape. It was like a game of cat and mouse, except there were 50 mice trying to herd one cat. In my case, one very dangerous cat. A group of embers rushed in to try ramming me from the front, and I opened fire. I blasted them into dust, swerving left to avoid the debris, then rotated my ship and fired back at the ones that came in too close. I had to immediately spin back around and veer upward to avoid another group approaching from that direction. As much as I missed M-Bot's voice, a part of me was glad for the chance to prove myself in these contests. I ignored my cytonic senses, they'd be useless against the real embers, and I didn't have an advanced AI to project and calculate for me. It was just me, the embers, and a wingmate. Today, that position was filled by a second force of carnage in the form of Braid. As I blasted ember after ember, the two of us finished our maneuver, swooping back together. We flew side by side for a moment, me firing forward while she rotated to fire backward, each of us covering a 180-degree arc. On my mark, we darted to the sides, then used our light lances to pull ourselves in mirrored maneuvers, swinging off embers even as they tried to collide with us. This move sent us hurtling back toward one another. We then crossed within centimeters as we opened fire, each blasting away the embers chasing after the other. When we swooped back around again, we were both free of tails. Heart pounding, a dangerous grin on my face, I fell in beside Braid. Together we flew away from the Delver Maze, almost like we were two ships being controlled by one mind. Braid was good. As good as I was. More, I clicked with her. We flew like we'd been wingmates for decades, rarely needing to even confirm with the other what to do. Perhaps it was because we were both cytonic, or maybe it was because our individual piloting styles were in sync. Over the last week, I'd spent time training with each member of the flight, but I never seemed to fly as well as I did when Braid was on my wing. At least until we spoke to one another. "Great work," I said over the communication channel.
"Don't compliment me on being so aggressive," she said. "I need to control it, not revel in it."
"You're doing what the superiority needs right now," I said. "You're learning how to protect them."
"It's still no excuse," she said. "Please, you don't know how it feels to be human."
I gritted my teeth. "I could help you," I thought. "Offer you freedom from this. Freedom to actually be yourself." I didn't say it. Instead, I switched off the comm. I felt that I was slowly getting through to her, but if I was going to make further progress, it probably wouldn't involve directly arguing against superiority ideals. I needed to be subtle. I could be subtle, right? Together, we rejoined the other ships and received a round of congratulations from Hesho and Morimer.
"You continue to fight well, Alanik," Vapor said to me. "You bear the scent of long rains."
I wasn't certain what that meant. Her language had some odd idioms that the pin could only translate literally.
"But remember, our task is not to chase and hunt these embers. Learning to dogfight is only a first step. We will soon have to practice flying that maze."
Morimer and Hesho took off to do a practice run, using another training exercise that I'd developed. I wasn't worried about training them to be expert dogfighters, but we did need to be working in pairs. "Vapor," I asked, "do you have any idea what this weapon is that we'll supposedly use to kill Delvers?"
"I do not," she said in her soft way.
It was odd, but I felt more comfortable speaking to her over the comm than I did in person.
"I am intrigued by the possibility, though," she added. "It would mean a great deal to society if Delvers could be killed."
I nodded to myself.
"I fear them," Vapor continued. "During the Second War, when the humans sought to control the Delvers and use them in battle, I caught a glimpse of how the Delvers see us. As specks or insects to be wiped away, they laid waste to worlds, vaporizing entire populations in moments. We didn't drive them off then, they just ended up leaving. We exist because they let us."
I shivered. If that's true, then all life in our galaxy lives with a gun to its head. All the more important that we should know if this weapon works or not, right?
"Agreed," Vapor said. "I find its possible existence.